nervous. But I think I should be nervous if I'm getting up here getting ready to tell my story. Did I say I'm an alcoholic?
Yeah.
Okay, damn, I'm already ahead of myself. Okay, first of all, I want to say that I'm incredibly grateful to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hey, Vivian. I'm really, really grateful to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. I thought I wanted to be like a movie star. I knew I wanted to be incredibly famous. I wanted everybody to pay attention to me. And what Ray read about humility is something that now I realize is a lot more important. I was on a flight somewhere. No, we were in Texas, and I was looking at this magazine, and there was this ad, and it says, "Isn't life better when you're envied?" And I thought, how creepy. You know, I just was like, that is so like the opposite of what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know, those things just don't really mean anything to me anymore. It's just a bunch of crap, really, you know. So anyway, took me a long time to learn that. So, alcoholism. I got a touch. I got a little bit of it. Okay. God, how do you... I don't know how to do this very well. So, I... start at the beginning. My dad was an army officer. My mom was a housewife. I had an older brother and sister, and I've said it many times. My most clear memories of my childhood were of me trying to get somebody's attention. You know, love me, hate me, don't ignore me. You know, just something, somebody, please pay attention to me. And my brother and sister were 5 and 7 years older than me, and they didn't really have any great use for a little kid running around after them. So I found myself, thank you, I found myself feeling kind of lonely, and we were army people and we moved around a lot, so I just say that to kind of identify. And that's why I talk about my childhood and my drinking history. It's not because I don't have a solution to offer, I do, but there's also might be a point of identification that somebody else here in the room can relate to and say, oh, yeah, that kind of, I had that in my life as well. So, I was a little girl, and I had these blue cat-eye glasses with rhinestones. It was about 1968, and my mom made all my nightgowns, and I had naturally blonde hair at that time. You know, that white blonde hair and a cowlick right back here, and the picket fence teeth coming in, and like this. Literally, I have a picture of my glasses are sitting in my face just like this, and I'm happy as a clam. I'm just... I thought about blowing up that picture and bringing it when I talk, because I'm like, this is really who I am. This is really... I want a big picture. There's a picture of me on my banana seat bike, you know, and just... I mean, that's how I feel inside. That's kind of who I am. I'm a big dork with cat-eye glasses, and, I woke up one morning, and even though I was incredibly uncomfortable for the most part during that time of my life, I remember waking up this one morning before everybody else woke up, and I went outside, and the dew was on the grass. And if you heard all, most of you heard all this stuff before, so I'm sorry, but it's just what happened, so I don't have any new material. I went outside, and I felt so good, and I felt so, high. I just felt so high. And I wasn't high. I was only 6 or 8 or something. And I went out in that grass, and I remember the sun was coming up over the trees behind my house, and I started spinning around and looking up into heaven and throwing my arms out, kind of like The Sound of Music. I'm thinking. I never did see that movie. We'll have to watch it sometime, Jill. But I know. I told you it was a neglected childhood. I didn't ever get to see The Sound of Music. So I remember that time in my life and just feeling so joyful and effervescent, you know, just like, wow, this is great stuff. I don't know what happened the rest of that day. I don't ever remember feeling like that again, but I remember that. And we moved around a lot, and we ended up in, I always say it's really boring. I didn't go to China or Japan or Germany or anywhere exciting. I traveled extensively in the southeastern United States. I've seen the sign, Sea Rock City, more times than I care to count. You know, I mean, I just, we kept driving through Chattanooga because that's, we didn't get very far from there. So we ended up in Huntsville, Alabama at Redstone Arsenal. My dad retired there, and I can't remember if it was his retirement party. I don't know. Christmas party. He had a retirement party at Christmas time. I can't really remember. But I remember that my dad poured me a glass of Ernest and Julio Gallo Rhine wine and kind of laughed, you know, haha, my little girl. I was 13 or something. Going to give her a drink of wine. Just a little splash. And he poured it, and it didn't make me gag as much as beer because I'd had some taste of beer. And he put the bottle in the garage, and I saw him do that. And so when I decided I needed a little bit more to wet my whistle, then I just went out and poured myself some wine. And to the best of my recollection, I drank about a half a gallon of Ernest and Julio Gallo Rhine wine. And as you can imagine, I was a little buzzed. I had a little drunk going for me, and people were paying attention to me then. My brother, as I said, was 5 years older than me, and he's probably a junior in high school at this time, and big, strapping, good-looking young man, and all his buddies were with them. This guy, Matt, I can't remember, Matt Lowry? I can't remember, Brian Lowry and Matt Aldridge. And they were huge basketball players, flaxen-haired Adonises, you know, and they paid attention to me. And it love me, hate me, don't ignore me. It wasn't necessarily good attention, but it was attention. And I got knee-walking, bed-spinning, puking drunk that night. And I can remember laying in the bed and was already, you know, already blacked out. Got my, I'm spread eagle because I'm trying to keep the bed from going, you know, and I'm spinning out. And my dad turns the light on, and I'm like, light off. And for days, he thought that was the funniest thing. He told that story, light off. Oh, she was so funny. Somebody was paying attention to me. I loved that. And I woke up the next day, and I say it all the time, but it's just the damn truth. I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait to do it again. Anybody ever feel like that after your first drink? I didn't care if I was puking out my nose. By God, what it gave me, good, outweighed all the bad. And I know a lot of people aren't pukers. I was, and I won't really go on and on about it, but just suffice it to say, I threw up a lot. But it didn't matter, because alcohol gave me what I needed. I felt like I fit in. And I don't remember ever looking back. I don't ever remember going, you know, maybe I should study harder, or maybe I should stay home, or, you know, I just wanted to get out and get drunk and do whatever else I could. And that was pretty much the way I drank and drug for the next 15 years. Sorry for the purist in here. I did smoke a ton of dope. And I thank God for that, because I think because of my limited capacity to, I was a cheap date. I think that marijuana did help me a lot to get into Alcoholics Anonymous, because I could stop one and not the, you know, I had to have something going all the time. I used to think I was doing really good if I wasn't doing the illegal thing, and but I always had to go back to the drink, because you'd run out of that. It's harder to get. It's illegal. So anyway, and I, you know, I was a drug dealer. I was a bar fly. I went to see my niece for the first time. She's going to be 20 next year. So I went to see her for the first time. She's a cute little baby in Huntsville, and by this time we'd moved to Florida. And I went up to see her, and I just loved her more than anything I've ever loved in my whole life, you know. And all that purity and goodness that I felt, and I felt so good and pure that I had to go out one night and get drunk with some of my brother-in-law's friends. And I got so drunk that I ended up in the hospital.
Shocker.
Yeah. I didn't remember that I had been hospitalized for alcoholic poisoning. My diagnosis was gastritis, but it was due to consumption of alcohol. And I didn't remember that, so I was about, I don't know, 90 days, 6 months or something. I remember, I kept thinking, oh, I've never been to jail. Well, I've never been to the hospital. I had a couple of fly-throughs. You know, I did the emergency room, and I spent about 3 hours in jail one afternoon with 13 of my closest friends for doing something illegal. And it wasn't driving a car drunk. Okay, fill in the blanks. So I did. I had a lot of troubles. But I think about that time that I just loved that kid so much. But I had to go out and get so hammered that I actually had to be hospitalized. And I missed my flight the next day, and I didn't get back to work. I worked at a defense contractor when I got arrested with my 13 friends and was in the front page of the Florida Today over in Brevard County. And it made my dad real proud to have his daughter's name, you know, an address. I don't know why they didn't put our phone number in there, but, you know, I was just a big, giant loser. And just to mention briefly, I don't know if anybody has any relationship issues. I don't anymore, so much. But back then I had this illusion that if you paid attention to me, well, that was just good enough. Because I was so desperate. God, it was so painful to say out loud. It's really painful that I did that sober, too. So, we don't have to, but that was my path. So anyway, I just didn't think a whole hell of a lot of myself. And nobody else did either, really. You know, my parents loved me and they tried to help me. But I really didn't want their help. I wanted to live at their house and drink every night and get in 1 minute before curfew. My mom would go, I'd say, I'm 25 years old. And she'd say, well, move out. And I'd be like, shocked. What? Man, I'm like 18. Get the hell out of my house. So, anyway, I couldn't get that, you know. I didn't like what she made for dinner. She was like, cook yourself. I didn't understand that. So anyway, that's kind of the loser I was when I drank. I hope I'm not all alone in being such a loser, but I was a pretty sad and twisted person. I didn't drink at home because my parents frowned on it, so I drove and drank a lot, drank in bars, and I had a lot of car wrecks, and it may irritate some of you to know that I never had a DUI. I knew all the cops in West Melbourne and in Melbourne Village, because there's not that many of them. And I can remember I got a ticket one night for following too close, and I always say, you know you were following too close if you hit them. And I got a ticket for following too close. I was so drunk that eyewitnesses were going, aren't you going to arrest her? And they were like, not this time. You know, I think that was like 88 or 89. So by the time, about 6 months before I got sober, I was unemployed. I was living off somebody else's good graces. I did move out of my parents' house because somebody else had offered to let me live at their house. I had to tell them I was in love with them. And, you know. And, I know, okay, so that sounds funny, but I was in a sticky situation, and I dearly did want to love him, you know, I really did, and when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, my first meeting, you are not going to, I just hesitate to tell this story because it's so incredible, but it's true. My first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I called the homeless hooker biker meeting. No offense to anybody who falls under that umbrella. I just... This girl actually talked about turning tricks in the first meeting I ever went to. If this is your first meeting, I'm really sorry. So anyway, I just couldn't identify with these people. I thought I was so much better than they were, you know. I was just like, oh my God, I wouldn't even drink with these people. And then, you know, I started hearing people talk after I came back, you know, 3 weeks later with my tail between my legs. I was like, okay, whatever, I don't care. I remember thinking about, or hearing other people talk about what, oh God, this is so uncomfortable. I'm so sorry I went down this path, but I got to finish. What prostitution really was. And I really was a prostitute. It wasn't a direct cash exchange. But thank you. God bless you. God bless you. Okay. That's all that matters. One person got it. So, three. Oh, you're three. Do I have four? So anyway, that was Labor Day weekend. I was saying 6 months before I got sober, whatever, I was living with a guy. I couldn't have stopped a long time before that, but I tried to stop and I couldn't stop. I was going to some counseling. My brother had picked me up and thrown me up against a jealousy window, which I richly deserved. I mean, I don't know, it didn't sound that bad, but it was pretty bad, and it felt pretty bad inside. My soul was like, I never really, well, I had had some experiences where I tried to think about my soul, but by the time I got to this place, it was just this void inside of me, and I just, God, it makes me kind of nauseous to think about how empty and vacant my life was. And I had a nervous breakdown, which is the good news. I had this nervous breakdown, and they sent me to a counselor at Circles of Care. That's the lakeside of Brevard County. And I went to several sessions, and she, you know, they pay attention to you for an entire hour. You are the center of attention, and it's great. I like that. I was about 20 years too late for therapy, but I was there. And she recommended that I go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I had a guy that I used to drink and drug with that I knew had about 3 or 4 months of sobriety. I'd heard through the grapevine, and I called him and asked him to help me get to a meeting. And he went to kind of a hard-ass men's group, excuse me for the ass part, but he went to this tough men's group, and I remember being on the phone with him, and he said, well, if you really want to get sober, you can find the meeting yourself. It's on Babcock, and I don't know if I can meet you there, but there'll be some people there that you can talk to. And I was like, okay. So I sat there, and I couldn't decide if I really wanted to go, and I broke into my parents' house because they were on vacation. And, I mean, I had a key, so I wasn't really breaking in. But the phone rang, and I answered it, and it was my cousin, Kathy. And she was getting ready to have a baby, and I hadn't talked to her in 5 years. Her brother had died 5 years before. He'd been murdered. He was a witness in a bad deal that went down, and these guys drowned him in the St. John's River up in St. Augustine. And when that happened, like, we didn't talk to them much anymore. They were really broken. And Kathy, the alcoholism's all through my family, and Kathy really, she disappeared. So I didn't talk to her for like 5 years. So here I am, trying on the fence, thinking if I should go to this AA meeting, and I get this phone call from my cousin I haven't talked to in 5 years, who's getting ready to have a child, and she's like, what are you doing? I said, well, I think I'm going to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and she said, go, they really helped me. And I went, okay. And I didn't know then that that was God reaching out to me. And I went to the homeless hooker biker meeting, no offense. I saw the leather, so, oh shit. I want you to know I really did pray before I got up here. I know it might not sound like it, but I really did pray. So I didn't think I belonged there, and I went out drinking the next 3 weeks, and The next night, that was a Thursday night. Friday night, we were all getting hammered. And I made a funny joke, as I'm apt to do. And this guy was going to make a funny joke at me. He was pretend assaulting me. It really was a pretend assault. And he stepped on the glass coffee table. It shattered. And the shard came out like this. And it went right into, like, the artery in his foot. And blood started shooting out everywhere. And I was just, like, going, you know, tourniquet and throw him in the bathtub, and we're all just freaking out and everything, and I'm like going, I'm all right. Those AAs are not having as much fun as I am tonight. You know what I mean? We got blood showers, you know, it's good stuff. So I did manage my drinking. I knew that if I drank more than two beers a day, that then I had a problem. So I drank two beers a day. I took 10 to 20 Valiums, and I did the other thing that we already discussed. And I did it a lot, and I drank my two beers. And by God, I had an allotment, and I was really excited about my two beers. It's the first time I had really been able to successfully control my drinking. I hope you like what I added to the mix. If you get that control there, I was really out of control. But, honey, I'm just going to tell the truth about what happened. So anyway, at my first meeting, I met this very handsome guy, and I knew him from school, and he was kind enough to ask me to go out to dinner and to some clubs and things like that. And I always say, I don't know if it's 13 stepping if you get them before they get sober. So, I don't know. That's your call. But all of a sudden, about 3 weeks after we had been dating, and he told me that he was going to an AA function, an AA party, and that I couldn't go because I wasn't in AA. I'd only been to one AA meeting, and I knew that that was BS. And I knew that there was some girl in Alcoholics Anonymous that he was seeing, and he told me I wasn't an alcoholic because I drank two beers, and he could never drink two beers. And that lasted 3 weeks, I believed that lie. Until that happened, I got off the two beer a day diet, and my last night of drinking up until this date was September 24th, 1990. And I started drinking. I was staying with a friend in South Melbourne Beach, and I started down there with some vodka drinks. Got to the bar, and I kept telling everybody. I saw people that I knew that had gotten out of treatment, and he was buying me drinks, and I was like, I can only have two. Two beers, that's my limit, because I don't have a problem. So I had two at the bar, two in the pool room, and two at the back. And, like, he couldn't see me. You know, like, none of these people could see me in the bar. Like, I disappeared after I had my first two drinks that they bought me, you know, and then I would. And I got so sick one more time. And I passed out at my brother's house on the bathroom floor, and I woke up about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I got up and I looked in the mirror, and I just said, I don't care what I have to do. I don't even know what the literal words were. I said, I don't care. I don't care if I've got to go back to that place, and I don't fit in with those people, and I'm really better than all of them. You know, I need some help. And I went to school the next day. I was in college, barely. And I left my class, and I remember telling my professor, I have to go. And he's like, why? And I'm like, I'm an alcoholic. And I don't remember if it was the 10 a.m. meeting or the 12 noon meeting. It was probably the 10 a.m. meeting since I had to leave class. And I don't know what happened on September 25th, 1990. I went to the 10, I went to the noon, I went to the 5:30, and I went to the 8. And the next day was Wednesday, and I went to the 10, and I went to the noon, and I went to the noon was an Al-Anon meeting, my first Al-Anon meeting, my second day. That should have been a clue. I didn't go back for like 10 years because I didn't like them. And they had my number. And I went to the 5:30, and I went to the 8. And I just kept going like that. I didn't drink. I didn't want to drink. I didn't think about drinking. I got sober on a Tuesday. Friday night was the NA dance, and it was suggested by all the young gentlemen that I should go. And I did. And before I went, getting into a lot of minutia here, but before I went, I had to stop by somebody's house. I had gone to their wedding about 3 months, God, was it even 3 months before that? I don't know. And the bride and I and the maid of honor had each drunk a bottle of champagne. What's the kind with flowers on it? That's it? Yeah, I can't even say it. But we each had a bottle. And we were just so hammered. They got married on a boat, you know, the river ship. Not the river ship romance, but the one in Cocoa Beach. So anyway, it was just a complete disaster. And I had to stop by their house on my way to this dance to pick up my little daytimer thing that I had ordered. Whatever, complicated minutia. And I walked in the door, and my friend Walter was standing there. He just looked crestfallen, you know. He's just devastated. And I was like, you know, what's going on? He goes, you look great. And I was like, you look terrible. What's going on? Well, I said, oh, I'm in AA now. That's right. You look great. I was like, oh, I'm in AA. No, I have 4 days. You know, I was like, woo, I'm going to a dance. And he's like, I just went to my first meeting today. You know, and he had, he's still sober. He's still sober today. I'd like to tell you that my cousin Kathy's alive. She died as a direct result of this disease. My friend that helped 12-step me, he went out after 12 years, was out for 2 years, was in for 2 years, was out. I don't know how long he was out the most recent time. My math's really bad. I might be off a little on those. But he called me in January and told me that, you know, he was scared and he was back in the program. He's in Jacksonville. And, you know, I don't know. I did a lot of things wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why. I really don't know why I stayed sober. My first year and a half, I brought my personality with me. My first sponsor had 9 months. I told her my problems, and she gave me Codependent No More. It's a nice book. It's not Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't help you recover from alcoholism, but it's a good read. And then I read Further Along the Road Less Traveled, or The Road Less Traveled, and then Further Along the Road Less Traveled. And I read a lot of non-conference approved literature, and I can remember people telling me, I read the books, I thought they were great, and I wanted to be able to share at the step meetings, you know, so I read them, but nobody ever took me through the steps. I had 18 months of sobriety, and was just nutty, was really, really nutty. And I had started to have the spiritual awakening that it talks about in the book. In We Agnostics, it says, God does not make too hard of terms with those who seek him. That means a lot to me, because I needed a really, really, like, simplistic idea of a higher power. I needed something really, really small. And they said that I just had to be willing, and that I could have a higher power, and that I could resign from the debating society, that I didn't really have to know. And I like that. During that first 18 months, when I brought my bar behavior into Alcoholics Anonymous, I read a book that's non-conference approved, but I feel like it really helped me a lot, and it's called A New Pair of Glasses, where Chuck C. talks about his idea of God and how every day is a prayer. Some of my prayers weren't so good, but I liked that idea. I got an idea about that I liked. And at 18 months of sobriety, something fabulous happened to me that didn't happen the first day that I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was broken. My behavior my behavior sober was unjustifiable. I could not say that I was drunk anymore. And I had gotten myself into such a spiritual and emotional, I like what Rob says about you circling the drain. You know, I was going down, and I was going to go out, and somebody offered to take me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't the woman that was sponsoring me at the time, but this woman became my sponsor, and she took me through the steps. And my life began to change, really change. Just being free from alcohol is a really, really big change. But it's nothing compared to what can happen in our lives when we work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I feel like I'm giving a pitch here. I made that decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God. And began to do the rest of the steps. I like to say that the fourth step is an introduction to myself. I did the four column form. Well, the first one I did was a little checklist thing from Joe and Charlie. Great tapes, great little thing. It got me started, but it didn't have a lot of depth to it. And eventually I did a four column format inventory. And it was really educational. I remember not knowing. I was like, calling my sponsor. I didn't have a part. I'm so sorry. You people really have a lot of problems, but my problems are everybody else. And you've heard this story before, a lot of you, that I used to, you know, really be mad at my dad for having to put up with me and the way he reacted to the way that I was. And there was a particularly, to me, a senseless spanking. It kind of went a little too far. And I like to focus on that senseless spanking. There really is no justification for what happened that day. I like to think about that a lot. I like to, you know, I call it picking the scab. You know what I mean? It's just like, let's just rip that off and look at it. And I would show up in my relationship with my dad PO'd because of what he did when I was 8 years old. And I was sitting there with my sponsor, and I am crying a river. I mean, you would have thought that he had healed me alive with razor blades or something. You know, I mean, I was just like going on and on and on. And thank you, Tinsel. And, and my sponsor said, you know, she was so compassionate. I wish I had more of that. And she said, you know, I can understand how that would have been very hard for you. And I'm so sorry that that happened to you. And how old were you? And I said, I was 8 years old, and the innocence of my childhood was taken from me. And she said, how old are you now? And I was like, are you listening to me? I mean, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, the waterworks stopped. I'm like, I'm supposed to be getting something here, but I'm not really picking up what she's saying. And what she was saying to me was that I was living in my relationship with just damn near everybody as an 8-year-old. I was a wounded little girl, and, you know, you were going to step on my toes just any second, so I was just going to show up ready, you know. And we'll just stick with that theme. So that was a very powerful fifth step for me. And in 6 and 7, you know, I looked at how I held on to that, and I had to become willing to let God take that from me. Many other character defects. I'm not going to go through the whole list of my character defects. I will say that another great character defect that I still get to enjoy today from time to time is that I will maybe pull you down just a little bit so that I feel maybe a little bit bigger. That's what happens when I'm disconnected from God. Isn't that creepy? I said it out loud, and it's true. I get to work on that. I get to make that mistake again, and I get to clean it up. I have a sponsor that makes sure that I do that. Let's see. Eighth step. A lot of women here know or have been sponsored by Linda N., and I can remember my step work with her. Still stuck on this parent thing, you know, and she'd be like, well, what would a good daughter do? And I had to write down what that was like. And then she asked me if I was willing to be a good daughter to my parents. My mom had passed away by this time. God, I really want to talk about my mom. I just loved her so much, and she died when I was sober. yeah, I'm going to lose it if I do that. And so what would a good daughter do? What would a good granddaughter do? What would a good sister do? What would a good friend do? And I kind of got to try to be that. I had some financial amends to make. I have some financial amends I'm currently making, that I've made mistakes in sobriety, that I get to write a check every so often. It's supposed to be every month. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's not. Just telling the truth. It's kind of crappy, but that's the truth. So, that's like so deep into my sobriety. That's like at about 8 or 9 years when I started doing that kind of step work in 8 and 9. Not that I didn't do it before, but this is what you get. I mean, this is just the order I'm telling it in. So I talked about being broken, and it happened at 18 months, and it happened again at about 10 or 11 years sobriety. I can't remember the exact Mike Fleming's back there one. Yeah, I remember that. I had the opportunity at about 10 years of sobriety. Well, right before my 10th anniversary, I almost got drunk again. It was the first time I had really seriously considered drinking alcohol since I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober on the East Coast. I moved to Orlando in 98. And I just kept trying to make this relationship thing go my way, and that I would be fixed by somebody outside of me. I know nobody else has ever done that. Because I have friends, I know that is not true. And it didn't go my way really bad one time. And it was like piling up. Do you know what I mean? It was like coming fast and furious. Like I was having all these bad relationships, and I was sober after all. And why wasn't I getting my way? And I like what Sandy Beach says, because I had a way. It had to be my way. And I had this preconceived idea about what was going to happen. I was going to get married and have a baby and be made valid, you know, in the eyes of society. If you're a guy or if you don't relate to that, that's fine. That was where my head was at. And I was at this guy's house, and he had a full bar. I was dating somebody that wasn't in the program, and he had a full bar in his house. Well, he had a full cabinet, let's just put it that way. It wasn't a literal bar. And I got down there, and I was looking through the cabinet. Now, why am I doing that? I'm in pain. I was in a lot of pain, and I'm like going, there's a bunch of old wine, you know, from somebody gave me a Christmas present. And then there were all these miniatures, and I remember looking at them and going, nobody would know. You ever thought that? Nobody would know. I had never really thought that before, you know? Not in sobriety. It never crossed my mind. And I did. I recoiled it from a hot flame. I picked it up first, but I recoiled it from a hot flame, and I put that thing back in there, and I ran to the closest meeting I could get to, and I hated everybody there. They were all full of it, but I didn't drink. You know? Well, I don't know if that was really true, but that was the way I felt at the time. And what started to happen is that after that experience, everything started to fall apart. I had financially gone bankrupt, and I had gone bankrupt in this emotional relationship thing, and spiritually I felt totally alone. And the great thing about being broken and the great thing about our character defects is that's just about the only time when I'm aware of those things that I need God. I don't just want God, but I need God, you know? And I began to seek for God in a way that I never had before. I didn't mean to quit dating for 2 years. I just didn't really think about it. It was kind of taken from me like a drink was. And I know some of my friends over here remember that time. And it was miraculous, wasn't it? It was indeed miraculous. I mean, they were like on, you know, they were saying amen to the choir. And God came into my life. I actually became, I remember there was a guy where I got sober over in Melbourne. He used to say his higher power, whom he'd choose to call the cosmic muffin. You know? And I had a concept of a higher power back then that it was, oh God, it's so embarrassing. And they let me come back. They just would say, keep coming back. that God was like this big ball of taffy in the sky, and that we were all little pieces of taffy. And like that worked for me. I mean, that was such a simplistic idea of a higher power that, I mean, I could work with that. And it's changed and developed over time, but during this time, I really felt like I wanted to get, well, I was a little self-righteous, maybe. And I really wanted to get close to God. And I'm not saying that my motives were not mostly pure. I don't know if as a human being they can ever be completely pure, but I began to seek a spiritual path, a religious path, and I pursued that really, really fervently. And I'm really grateful for that time. And I remember saying to my friend Paul that I would say, break me, you know, and he'd say, don't say that. He'll do it, you know. And I said, that's okay, because if being this close to him is the price of being broken, that's fine with me. And I like what Chuck C. says in A New Pair of Glasses. Why, oh why, does this thing called the ego have to come back? I wish I had the answer to that. I wish, but I don't. But ego does. It sneaks back in sometimes. It's just like sprinting right up to you, you know. I don't know. So it really changed my life. It really changed my life. And I'm really grateful for the broken times in my life. And I am grateful for my character defects. If I didn't have them, I wouldn't have a relationship with a higher power. I'd be fine. I'd be good, and I wouldn't really... I'd come here just to spread the wisdom and not really to get any help. But those of you who know me know that I come for help a lot. So I got up to step 9 in that little ditty. And today, I'm pretty consistent with step 10. I like to occasionally pick up my journal. Sometimes it's very shocking. I'll do some writing every once in a while, and then I put it down, and then I go back, and it's like 3 months later, and I'm like, God, you know, I really haven't reviewed my life for 3 months other than just, you know, having a phone appointment with my sponsor. Excuse me. So I like the 10th step. I like working the 10th step as checking in through a journal. I also like doing a 4 through 9, a mini 4 through 9. I think it's really important. I think it's really important because invariably when I get over to the fourth column, it's the same character defects that were in my first 87 inventories. Okay, I haven't done 87, but, you know, it's just, it doesn't change. What changes the cunning, baffling nature of this disease, it's trying to get at me at any way it can to help bring me down, to get me a little closer to a drink. And, okay, step 11. I'm just moving right along. I don't know how fast this feels for you, but I feel like I've been here 5 minutes. I know it doesn't feel like 5 minutes to you. Step 11. I wanted to talk about step 11 really quickly. I actually want to talk about really long, but I don't have that much time left. I really like the prayers that are given to us in our big book. I really love the third step prayer. I don't know if Brent's here tonight, but I love it that Brent, well, almost every time he shares, he talks about the third step prayer. You know, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do your will. Take away, this is a great one, take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to him. Or the cosmic muffin or whatever. Whatever higher power is working in your life. And if I'm not already broken, do I need him to come in and help me overcome anything? Do not my challenges make my blessings richer? I know that they do. I know that they do. And God, I want to talk about my husband. But I got to talk about step 12. I got to talk about step 12. I know, I'm running out of time. So, step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I tried to practice principles and offers. Oh, yeah, I'm the alcoholic thing. I carry this message to alcoholics. I love coming to meetings. I love coming and seeing the new people come in. I love seeing the old people. I love, not old, but, you know, old timers or whatever. I like us all to, I love the level playing field of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we all have the disease of alcoholism, and that if you choose, if I choose, I have a common solution. And it's the literature. What's written in the literature, I believe, came through Bill and Bob, through a higher power. I really believe it's divinely inspired. And, okay, like the whole relationship thing, let's get back to that. The whole relationship thing, I was like really crazy and I was broken and I came to God and He entered my life and I threw myself into this program in a way that I never had before. And I enjoyed it immensely. And it talks about... Keeping you up over there? It talks about on page 89, life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives, and that has truly come to pass in my life. I mean, I'll just say Sally, because she's here. Oh, and Sandy, she's great. I saw Sally come in about 9 months ago, and she was real quiet, and she didn't want to say anything, and now she's chairing meetings, and she's doing I don't even know what you're doing with the treatment center. She's involved. Yeah, she doesn't even know. She's like, whatever, I'm here. I watched her get something here, and I watched her want to pass it on. And Sandy, I don't know if I said this to you, but I told a couple other people today, because it came to me at the meeting we were at earlier, that you were like a human tuning fork. You were just vibrating, you know? You were just sitting there, and her bangs would quiver at the 6:30 meeting. And then at 30 days, she quit shaking. I got to watch Sandy quit shaking, you know? That is the bright spot of my life. And being able to live that kind of life, I think, and to learn something about the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to learn something about God. It's allowed me to learn something about selfishness, which brings me to my marriage. That I never knew how selfish I was living by myself with my two cats. I never knew how selfish I was until I met Ray and I saw a really, really fine human being. And I remember when he asked me to marry him, I was totally thrilled, but it also completely freaked me out because he's such a fine man and he's got such great principles and he wanted to marry me. And I know me. And I didn't think he was getting such a good deal. But because of principled sponsorship, because of consistent application of this program, I know that I can be a good wife to him. Okay, I'm not winning any awards because it's really hard work. But instead of like, oh my God, this is what I always wanted, and it is what I always wanted, but I never had any idea what hard work it would be. And I'm so grateful for the work. Because it's changed who I am inside. It's changed my concepts about what's really meaningful in the world, like to be envied. Who cares? You know, to have something to offer to somebody else is really the only reason that I feel like we're here. And I'm so grateful to everybody that came tonight, my friends. Whitney, so good to see you. And just all the girls from the heart, and it's just really nice to have you all there. Jim, look at him, he's all choked up. And I don't know if I said it at the beginning. I know I said I'm really grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm really grateful to have been asked to share my story. I know I'm off the hook for at least another couple years. And I'd like to thank the girls that I sponsor that came out tonight. And Lori, I left my phone at home. Thank you.